Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timory.
The greatest movie of all time turned 30 this year, Timory, and I assume you know which one I'm talking about, The Princess Bride.
That movie was heavily quoted in my education at university.
Oh, man, what a fantastic movie this was. Maybe not the best of all time, but easily in my top five for sure. I can't think of one that I would have watched as many times. I love The Princess Bride. I remember the first time I saw it, I was a senior in high school, actually, just to show you my age. And we were in school in this small town. I was actually at a boarding school. And we all got in somebody's car and took a trip to the big city because there was no theater in our town. And we went to see Princess Bride. And I remember because I remember this red-haired girl that I went to school with. And it wasn't anything romantic. It was a big group of us. But she had the loudest and funniest laugh. And she laughed. I mean, it was a hilarious movie, but I just remember that laugh. Oh, she laughed through this whole thing. What a fantastic movie.
My one quote that comes automatically to mind, as you wish.
Oh, it's eminently quotable.
I mean, all the time.
My wish is what brings us together today. It's so many good quotes.
I do have to say the inconceivable one. My professor, some of you may know, Dr. Michael Barber, when I was in undergrad and grad school with him, would say that all the time. And he would just have me rolling. He could do it perfectly.
So Thomas Hibbs has an actual think piece about The Princess Bride at Catholic World Report this week. And I encourage you to go check it out because he brings a lot of good points about The Princess Bride. And one of them is, it's just a great love story, and love story in the right sense, right? Like, when you think about a classic fairy tale love story, which is what this was, and apparently, I actually haven't read the book, but my wife, we have the book sitting out on our, I think it's out on our front table for some reason right now. The book is even better than the movie, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, it's fantastic. But a classic love story where you have righteousness extolled and free will extolled. And there's a lot of, you notice there's a lot of tests during the process saying, all right, do you love me? Are you trustworthy? Are you the kind of person that's going to remain faithful through this? And they go through all of these, you know, the fire swamp and being tortured and all of these things and being forced to marry someone else. And the question throughout the film is this person going to remain faithful to their true love? And throughout the movie, they always have to make a conscious decision to say, yes, I'm going to exert my will right now to be with you forever, to extol you, to remain faithful to you. And I just think, I don't know if we thought about this, but I just think that's one of the reasons, beyond all the great comedy and the wonderful cast. I mean, what a great cast it was.
Right.
All the wonderful parts of this movie. Just the picture of actual true love. Like, that's what true love is, right?
And that love is free.
Yeah.
It's chosen. But when you make that commitment, it's permanent and it's faithful and it's fruitful. All these different elements that people learn from a simple story such as Princess Bride. And it shows the great impact of movies and stories on us, but how we can treasure certain good examples.
And you think about what a different movie that would have been. I just want to do a thought experiment. I assume most of you have seen it. If you haven't, what are you doing with your life? All right, come on, go watch it right now. What a different movie it would have been if they had, as so often happens in modern movies, they had slept together the first time they had met.
Right.
If Buttercup had, you know, given away her virginity to this guy years and years ago, and now they met, it's a completely different story. The fact that it was faithful and free and all of these things, the love that they had, really, I think, distinguishes it from so many of our tawdry stories today.
Well, and I love where you talk about how basically the relationship was tried. You know, it was tried over and over and over again. And, you know, I think a lot of people today have no element of trial in their relationship because they jump right into bed. And, you know, from the beginning, everything is challenging. Everything's a trial. And we're revving forward like a motor in a car, following our sexual desires, but we don't actually get to pull back and see, is this person safe? Is he faithful? Is he committed? Is he loyal? You know, I think that that's something that we don't even see in friendship a lot of the time because we can objectify people. And so there's such a beauty to going, yes, each friendship or even relationship, maybe you date longer than you'd like before marriage. But, you know, you learn over and over again this trial and how important it is.
Yeah, a couple of things with that. You brought up a good point about asking questions about the other person, right? Is he faithful? Is he a good person? You know what? People don't ask those questions anymore.
Right.
Primarily because they're just thinking, what am I going to get out of this person? Mm. And when you do ask those questions, it absolutely transforms how you approach them. And you know how to ask those questions most effectively? You ask, would this person be a good father? Would this person be a good mother? Those are the questions we used to ask, right? Like, if I'm going to marry you, it's because I think you're going to be a good parent to my children. I'm not going to spend a lot of time and energy on you. I'm certainly not going to give you my body if you're not going to be a good parent. And before contraception was so widely available, that is the question people asked, right? That's why sex was so expensive, that you need to be the kind of person that's going to raise my kids. And so you're going to have a better marriage by asking those questions. Right. We don't even ask those anymore. It's like, all right, I'm just going to use you. You're just going to use me for one night. We don't even need to know each other's names, but it's a transformative question.
Right. And this is actually a teaser even for the last segment of our show. I'm seeing how this ties in because our last topic today is this piece that was written, and it's titled The Death of Eros. And one of the things it talks a lot about is how it used to be before, you know, abortion contraception was so readily available and was the norm, that women were looking to see what type of responsibility was the man going to show, and how they were looking to see how could a man provide and sacrifice himself for her. And that helped determine the level of commitment she was then willing to make, and how that ring isn't just a nice pretty bit of bling on the finger, but it was actually a symbol of sacrifice from him. And that then you would give over your sexual intimacy to this individual.
Yeah. And you saw that, as you mentioned, in The Princess Bride. So you have all of these trials, right? And as they pass through each test and come out the other side stronger and more character filled, right? Like, they become stronger people as they pass all these tests. By the end, they're like, well, these are two amazing people. They're going to have an amazing life. By not asking those questions and by not going through those tests, I mean, how do we look at tests now? We think, oh, well, as soon as that feeling that I have for you, that whatever it is, you know, all of the chemicals running around in my brain and I'm attracted to you, and we'll just call that love and we'll get married and it'll be fine. Knowing that as soon as that feeling's gone, I'm going to be gone and you're going to be gone. As soon as you hit any sort of test, any sort of roadblock, it doesn't become something that, you know, builds your character. It becomes a reason to part. And so what a difference. What a different way to look at it we have in The Princess Bride, I think.
Well, and it keeps bringing me back, and I talked about this last week on the show, of that emotional response, not just in relationships, but in friendships. And Daniel Matheson, in his book, Why I Don't Call Myself Gay, ends the book with a phenomenal segment on friendship. And it's something that I know so many people can really resonate with, because he talks about how just in basic friendships, we have this emotional dependency that is not correct. This idea that they're going to make me feel fulfilled and accomplished and all these different things, that they need to satisfy my desire of loneliness or conversation. Yes, you know, you do have that companionship and friendship, but it's not what needs to fulfill a emotional desire.
Right. There's a difference between needing that person to fill an emptiness in me.
Right.
There's a difference between that and having that person sacrifice themselves for my good. Right. You're getting something from the person both ways. But there's a big difference between I'm a needy person who is looking for you to basically use you to fill up that thing, and you being the kind of person that would sacrifice yourself for my good. That's love. And my good, sometimes I may not even recognize it, right? Like I may need to be straightened out in some area, and you acting for my good is going to make me feel bad, frankly. But it's still for my good. And that's what love is. And ultimately, we want to be married to people. We want to spend our lives with people who are willing to sacrifice themselves for our good. Not who exist to meet some perceived need in me.
Right.
And that's a good distinction. That's a big difference.
Well, and that's the beauty of the friendship of virtue. Aristotle talks about friendship of virtue, pleasure, and utility, and how the basis of your friendship is utility, how the other person's useful. If they're no longer useful, that friendship fizzles away. Or the basis of the friendship's pleasure. They're no longer pleasurable, that friendship fades away, or you're a fair weather friend following the pleasure. But when virtue, like you said, the center of that relationship, the bridge between the two of you, is that you want the good of the other to the point that you don't even complain about or to that person about them unless that complaint benefits them to be a complaint, not a complaint, but saying, hey, I'm concerned for your good, and not, hey, this is an aggravating habit that you have. That is true love. You will the good of the other.
I think what you meant to say is twoo-wove. I think that's the correct. We encourage you, please go. If you haven't seen Princess Bride, go check it out. There's much, much more in the movie. Justice is a major theme in the movie. And I think like a proper view of justice, not vengeance, but justice is great. You killed my father. Oh, yes. So good.
Oh,
so
that's
good.
A good one.
Plus, you've got Fred Savage before the Wonder Years. Basically learning how to appreciate true romance as sort of the overarching story within which the fable is set, and I think it's a masterpiece. So go check out The Princess Bride.
Timmery and Dawn will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's TIMMERIE and at Dawn Johnson Media. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Dawn and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
So really neat news, something to keep your eye on for Catholic geek out moment. There's a possible new Marian apparition in India to a handful of schoolgirls. And one of the girls was entering into the church. She blessed her ear that was hurting with holy water. She says that it was healed and that she goes to proceed into the church with some of her other classmates. And Our Lady ends up appearing to them. Since then, a number of people have gone to this place for prayer. And Our Lady did appear again to the girls, although no one else could see her yet. At the same time, a number of people said that they experienced the gift of contrition, feeling sorry for their sins. And so the diocese there in India has basically said, we're taking the approach of wait and see what will happen. So,
yeah, two things I like about this story. One, these kind of things do happen. We know that. And two, the Catholic Church is an institution. And if you're just joining us, you're with Dawn and Timmery. And I know we've got a lot of new listeners on Relevant Radio, especially on the East Coast. You can find out more about us at trendingdt.com or dawnjohnsonministries.org or timmery.com. Please check that out, and we'll give you more information later in the show. But I'm a Catholic convert, and one of the things that I love about the Catholic Church is it doesn't just blindly accept these things. Like, on one hand, they happen. We know that they happen, but it doesn't just blindly accept it. It goes in, and it tries to verify.
Scientifically, and of course, it's a mystery, but there's science.
At the same time, and they're very thorough in going about verifying these things, and they're very hesitant to say that, okay, this actually happened. And so it's not one of those deals where you just put your brain in your back pocket and you accept everybody's story. But on the other hand, it's not one of those deals where we just don't accept people's stories either. So fantastic story. I hope that does turn out to be verified, because that's pretty neat stuff.
And some things that are private revelations aren't verified as well.
So, yeah.
You know, neat element as well there. But in the meantime, millennials and freedom. This is, I think, a really tough topic right now for a lot of young people to figure out where they stand on the issue.
The New York Times last Sunday had a very interesting article about millennials, of which Timmery is one and I am not. But according to the World Values Survey, only about 30% of Americans born after 1980, that would be you, right? You're born after 1980, Timmery.
Yes.
Believe that it's absolutely essential to live in a democratic country. 30% value democracy in the sense that, well, it's essential. Yeah, we want to live in a democracy. They're also disproportionately skeptical of things like free speech. The Pew Research Center found that 40% of millennials believe that the government should be able to regulate certain kinds of offensive speech. That's up from only 27% of people like me, Gen Xers, and only 12% of the greatest generation, those 70 or older. They're like, yes, free speech, absolutely. They're sort
12%
of
12% of them are objecting. Otherwise,
everybody's on board
yes.
with that. Whereas yeah. now the youngsters are like, yeah, we're not sure.
Is there something to be said not only of having grown up in a different era, a different time, but also with wisdom and time, you realize the importance of freedom?
Maybe. I mean, I'm not sure. I feel like there's more to be said with the culture that they grew up in. Where today, because I get it, frankly, I get why millennials look around and say, do we have to let all of this stuff be said? Because there's just so much garbage being spewed everywhere. People are so angry and so offensive. And it's just like, yeah, there's a lot of filth. I mean, I feel like as I'm trying to regulate my kids, you know, here I am, a guy with four kids from 16 to 6. And I think, yeah, I do a lot of regulating in my household. This is not a free speech zone. It's not a free media zone, you know. And sort of feel like, yeah, I get it.
Well, it is a free speech zone in that you are open to conversation, dialogue, and learning, but it's not open to inappropriate, disrespectful speech.
Well, and here's the key. And I feel like this is, I don't know if they talk about this, frankly, so much in the article, but this is what I think is the key. You talked about values and appropriate. What's appropriate and what's not?
Yes.
Well, today, who's to say what's appropriate and what's not? For those people in what's called the silent generation, or the beyond the boomers, the World War II generation, they knew what was appropriate and not. They had a very clear understanding in general. Of course, we had some outliers, but in general, there was an accepted way you would act in public. There were things you would say and not say. Mm-hmm. And although not everyone was Christian, of course, we get that, there was an accepted, what we would call, Judeo-Christian worldview.
Absolutely.
Underlying most of the laws, not even the laws, yes, the laws too, but underlying, you know, public discourse.
Absolutely.
And that has disappeared, all right? Mm. I mean, that is gone for the most part. Just a little few things left here and there. But in general now, it's a free-for-all. You can just say and do whatever, and not only is it going to be accepted, but some of the more what I would call vulgar things are celebrated. Yeah, let's be happy about that. Let's put that increasingly nasty, vulgar image out there and celebrate it. And let's make media that's pornographic and violent and degrading and call it art. And that's different.
Well, and that also is really an impact of the change in what we view as moral and legal. You know, we talk about abortion and contraception, you know, the silent generation that came on the scene kind of at the end or after their childbearing years,
right,
for the most part. And so that's not something they lived with. That's something that they understood usually is right and wrong. And, you know, they knew it was right and wrong, and then it's made legal. Well, we have a whole new set of generations now that they perceive what is legal is moral and what is then normal. And, you know, at the same time, it makes me think of a story this weekend. So I live with a older woman, and she's wonderful. And I walked up to go and help her with a computer thing this weekend. And she says, a group of Norbertine priests and seminarians are about to head over to the house and should be there any moment. And they're going to have a private mass that morning. And I had a friend in town, and we had plans. But she said, you're welcome to join us. And, you know, she's quickly chatting. And all of a sudden I pause because I'm like, in delay. This is awesome. The Norbertines are here. They're going to celebrate mass. But we've got plans, you know? And so it's so funny because I think, like, she sees me pause. I'm like already in this dilemma and kind of looking over at my friend. And she said something that really stood out to me. She said, you're free. Do whatever you want. If you have plans, go do it. This is a free choice for you to make. And it wasn't going, don't feel guilty because it's mass. She said, but you're free. Go in whatever direction you want. And I think that a lot of people would kind of be like, well, you should go to mass. You know, this is the better thing to do, or whatever it is. There's this element of freedom and this attitude that she had that I think a lot of the time we make so many decisions under pressure.
Yeah, well, it's one thing to be free under an established moral code.
So, and this is, I think, what's important, Don, because it made me think, I was reflecting on this all day after, because I was thinking about children and I was thinking about cell phones and how, you know, that debate of when and at what point does a child have a cell phone. And it made me think about what you mentioned earlier in your house. You know, your kids don't have free rein. Totally, because they need to learn principles. And once they understand the principles and then you work through the principles and the respect of other people, then you introduce the phone, right? And then at a certain point, you no longer have as much jurisdiction. And then at a certain point, you have none over how they do and don't use their phone. But you establish the principles early on that when they're totally free and out of your home later on, there's a sense of, yes, they're free, but they know right from wrong.
Well, and that's what true freedom is. And so this is, hopefully we don't have much time left in the segment, but when I say they're free in my house, they can make decisions. They can decide, you know, within reason what they can do. There's parameters there. Right. Because I know that as fallen human beings, if I do not give them any parameters at all, their decisions will actually not lead them to be more free, but to be less free. They will become addicted to things like sugar and phones and
right.
pornography and all of these things that, you know what, maybe they ran across them at one point, but I know that those things are not freeing. Those are very addictive, controlling things. Mm. And my rules are actually there to provide them an opportunity to be free. To be truly free, they have to be able to say to the sugar cereal or the pornography or the whatever, they have to be able to say no. What we have done in our culture is said, just do whatever. There's no rules. Do whatever. And as Raymond Burke, the great moral philosopher, said, you know what? Your passions are your fetters. Whatever you desire is what you are enslaved to. Well, desiring God makes you free to be completely righteous. Mm-hmm. When you are desiring other things, you actually become enslaved to sin and to Satan. And that is what we have. We have a culture in which what you have is where kids have been told, just do whatever. And they say, you know what? Not only does that provide me a lot of stress, I would actually prefer to have somebody sort of guide me. It's a lot of stress to make all those decisions all the day. But it actually enslaves me. I end up being enslaved to certain things. And they're actually crying out for some sort of control. We need the government. We need somebody to step in here and provide us some rules and some structure, because I can't handle this. I don't feel free. I feel like I'm being oppressed and enslaved.
But then they truly lose their freedom.
Absolutely, they lose their freedom. If you're not free inside, if you're morally not free, as a society, we will call to not be free on the outside. That's sort of the trade-off. If you're not going to be righteous and have self-control, there will be more government control.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. This is Trending with Don and Timmery on Relevant Radio. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit DonJohnsonMinistries.org or Timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
You know, Don, it's ironic. After all that's coming out regarding Weinstein and the sexual abuse and this rape culture that has been rampant in Hollywood, that I know many people have been blowing the whistle on, and now this huge scandal has, you know, really inflamed this Twitter, Facebook, Instagram campaign of Me Too and all of the people coming out saying that they've also have been sexually abused just by posting Me Too online. Well, the irony of it in some ways is that all of a sudden people are realizing, oh, they support abortion. They're women's rights advocates. They're in favor of contraception. Whether it's Hugh Hefner, who recently died, or Weinstein, who's a major supporter of Planned Parenthood and contraception. Hugh Hefner, who actually filed a couple of pieces on the Roe v. Wade case,
absolutely,
is, of course, a huge supporter of abortion and contraception. You guys, hello. Is there any surprise that they want to cover up the rape? That they want to cover up marital infidelity, that they want to cover up a teenager that they're sexually abusing? Of course they are.
This has really been one of the more ironic and interesting aspects of this very sad story about the abuse that Harvey Weinstein has inflicted on women for years and years, that in the press coverage, I'm thinking of a New York Times article here, but also different places, they're just flabbergasted that he was a big supporter of what they're calling women's rights. And by that, they mean contraception and abortion. How could he possibly support Roe versus Wade? And if you look at who brought the abortion culture in, and again, I have been working on this documentary. Of course, I know for our new relevant listeners, you may not be aware, but Timmery does a lot of speaking on pro-life issues. Please go to timmery.com and invite her to an event. And I speak as well, but I'm also a filmmaker, and I'm working on a new documentary about the sexual revolution. And the women's rights movement, as you know, early on, was, of course, very anti-abortion. The suffragettes, for example, who brought us the vote for women, would have been appalled and were appalled at abortion. They thought it was murder. It was actually men like Larry Lader who wrote a very influential but very wrong book about abortion. He made up a whole history of the Catholic Church and told lie after lie about abortion in history.
And this seriously impacted Roe v. Wade and Doe versus Bolton.
They based many of their decisions off of this very false piece of propaganda. But later, not only did he write this propaganda piece, but along with guys like Rockefeller and guys like Hugh Hefner, got together and, I don't know if you want to say convinced, but they strongly influenced many of the women of the time, including people like Betty Friedan, who was originally not a huge fan of contraception and abortion, actually. And she's, of course, the founder of NOW, the National Organization for Women. And she was very strong on contraception and abortion by the time she's founded NOW. But there was a big battle at the founding of NOW, and she had to be convinced by guys like Lader and Rockefeller and, of course, people like Hefner. Why were the men so influential? Why were the men so strong on, we need abortion? Well, you could look at the business side of it. The business side was, hey, women want to be in the workforce. Well, guess what? When you get pregnant, you're no good to me.
Maternity leave, they
home.
Didn't want to pay.
You're not doing anything
like
at home.
Later on.
So for them to be able, for a woman to be able to say, oh, I'm on the pill or I'm going to abort, was a huge deal. Okay, so then we can basically treat you like a man. But on the more seedy side of it, and if there is such a thing as a more seedy side of abortion, the fact that people like Hefner could objectify women and treat them the way that Harvey Weinstein has treated women and happens all over the place, that objectifying of women only works if when you get pregnant, if and when the contraception fails, and frankly, it almost always fails.
Right.
We need to be able to get rid of that baby.
Absolutely.
Abortion was absolutely essential to the pornography business, to all of these things. Of course, people like Weinstein support abortion.
Well, and it is left on the woman to take care of her business. You know, for those, so hello to Relevant Radio. My name is Timmery, and I'm happy to be with you and have more listeners. But I worked in the Crisis Pregnancy Center for a number of years. I did 5 years working as a director of education and outreach, and I have worked in the pro-life movement since I was a little girl. I worked both politically and doing activism over the years. And now, you know, I travel speaking on abortion, contraception, gender ideology, really the toughest sexual topics of our current time. And it is not surprising as I look right in front of me as women and men are writing all over the media right now about Weinstein and his connection to the women's rights movements and how they're disgusted by it. But it's been there all along. There's a piece by Vanity Fair recently, or back in 2010, that's being shown yet again. And Hugh Hefner's being really essentially interviewed. And the woman asked, but feminists still oppose you for treating women as objects. Here's what Hugh Hefner says. They are objects, he insisted. Playboy fought for what became women's issues, including birth control. We were the amicus curiae, friend of the court, and the Roe v. Wade, which gave women the right to choose. But the notion that women would not embrace their own sexuality is insane. So he's sitting here saying, we gave you women the right to choose. You are objects. But while we gave you freedom, you should have been embracing your sexuality. So we helped you to do it.
In the middle of the feminist movement, especially when it became so pro-contraception and pro-abortion. Well, there's cognitive dissonance at the heart of the women's movement when they say, except for people like Helen Gurley Brown, who just accepted the whole object thing. Yep, I'm a sex object. But most didn't, right? Like, most say, no, I don't want to be a sex object. I don't want you as a man to objectify me. However, I want contraception. I want abortion. I want all of the freedoms, in quotes, that go along with that. Those two things do not go together. Contraception and abortion, by their very nature, are objectifying acts. Premarital sex, by its nature, is an objectifying act, which is what contraception allows, right? Even contraception itself, even within marriage, frankly, is an objectifying act. It makes sex something where one person is using the other person. That's what contraception does. So women who fought for contraception and abortion were essentially fighting for the right to be objectified by men. That, by its nature, that's what those things do. And so there has always been this cognitive dissonance in the middle of that movement where it says, oh, on one hand, I don't want to be objectified. On the other hand, I want to be naked on your magazine and use contraception and do abortion and all those things. But how does that work? Oh, yeah, it doesn't work. That's the problem.
Because women have been treated with misplaced value. Where is your value? It's in what you can do for me. You know, even to the point now, we covered this leisure on a recent episode, but how a lot of us view our value in the work that we do and how productive we are. But women not only often view their value in how they are sexually, but just what can you do in the workplace? But it's, we're so much more than that. And it's this misplaced sense that is creating so much damage for women. And having seen women in the crisis pregnancy centers over the years, women who maybe weren't as educated or came from a broken home and their parents didn't invest in helping them and just basic life skills, how then all they saw were basically, my value is my sexuality and I can allow people to use me in any way whatsoever, and that's who I am.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Timory. The two main women in the 60s, early 60s, 62 and then 63, their books came out. So you had Helen Gurley Brown, Sex and the Single Girl, and Betty Friedan in 63 with The Feminine Mystique. So Friedan said, your value is in your work. She wanted women to get out of the house, stop changing diapers, get out there and get a career. Mm-hmm. And for Helen Gurley Brown, it was go and have some promiscuous sex.
Right.
So you just the exact two things you just pointed out, your career and your sexiness. And Brown was forever talking about how we looked and how sexy you can be for men, whereas Friedan was talking about how much we needed the careers. Well, those two things, you know what, as good as they are, right? I mean, it's not bad for a woman to have a career. It's not bad for a woman to take care of her body. I mean, right? Inherently, they're not bad. But when you try to invert a woman's inherent value and replace it with those things, and where does a woman, frankly, I mean, what is a woman? Your reproductive ability is not a separate part of you.
Yes. What's fundamental to our reproductive systems, what is so beautiful about our bodies, is that we have the potential for life. And not that that's a reduction of who we are. There's a deep and profound respect that reveals so much more about the woman at the same time. You know, I am fascinated. So I'm also a Pilates trainer. And I see primarily women who come in. And I also train, you know, athletes. We have a recently retired pro ball player, some neat people. But it's interesting because I see these women who are caring for their bodies. And we're going through essentially, you know, forms of post-physical therapy or workout classes, depending on if it's a private or a group session. And I see these women and the goodness they have in their hearts, but also the brokenness and journeys that each and every woman has gone through and the choices she has had to make.
Yeah. Interesting piece by Doug Wilson this week, who says the difference between a Christian hypocrite who preaches sexual morality and then doesn't do it, that's what a hypocrite is. The difference between that guy and a lot of the stuff we see happening, like, for instance, Harvey Weinstein, the Christian is disobeying their catechism. They're not doing what their institution tells them to do. Whereas those who are involved in the sexual revolution, they're actually following their catechism.
They're living what they believe.
Living it out. They're actually doing what they were told. We're doing what we were taught. That's a big difference. Right. They're not. Weinstein is not a hypocrite. He's a bad guy who did a lot of bad things. But ultimately, he's doing what he was taught to do.
So, and it makes us ask two questions. Where do you place your personal value? Is it in your job and your sexuality, your talents, Or is it in just being you? And then two, what do you believe?
Timmery and Dawn will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Dawn Johnson Media. From the Southern California studios of Relevant Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Dawn and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
We live in a culture, Timmery, where it seems like a lot of people in power are doing a lot of bad things. It's like almost hard to keep up with all of the evil that is happening. And, you know, it does seem to be true that power corrupts and that those who are given it have to have the right character. You know, as Christians, we believe that character is destiny, ultimately, that God wants us to make us a certain kind of person. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's all about, right? Unless you're becoming that sort of loving person, bearing the fruits of the Spirit, you're not doing what God intended. Like, your life is not reaching the fulfillment of what it could be. And so that's why we look for, you know, whether it's business leaders or Hollywood moguls or politicians or whatever, ultimately what I look for is character. I want you to be a certain kind of person. Otherwise, you know what happens when you get into that power? Whatever character faults you had before, they're going to be magnified. Right? Like, that's what we try to teach our kids, isn't it? Like, you don't steal that piece of gum. Well, it's just a piece of gum, Dad. No, it's not just a piece of gum. It's that you stole. It's not your gum. Right? You can't take something that's not yours. If you don't stop it then and explain that it's the principle, it's not the value, and the kid becomes the kind of person who is willing to take something from others or to break those principles, and they grow up and they become head of a multi-million-dollar company, are they going to be the kind of person who might cheat their shareholders or take a bribe or sexually, you know what I mean? Like, if your character's not there and you're given power, yikes, who knows what might happen. So I just want to point
Hold
out.
Hold on. I just have to throw this in here.
All right.
Total side note. But when you were speaking, I thought of the My Fair Lady quote where Colonel Pickering says, "Are you a man of good character where women are concerned?" And then Professor Hitchens says, "Have you ever met a man of good character where women are concerned?" And Colonel Pickering says, "Yes, very frequently." And it makes me think of a return to that love and responsibility for other people that we're looking for.
Well, yeah, it sounds simplistic, but couldn't all of our cultural problems be solved if everyone was a little bit more holy, right? Like a little bit more righteous, like we actually had character. We actually had those qualities. And it concerns me that we have downplayed character qualities at the expense of, you know, other things that have become more important. You know, like I talk about sports sometimes and just as an illustration, right? Like, I'm actually not a huge sports fan anymore. I was a little bit more when I was a kid. I watch it occasionally. And I notice in sports, character quality doesn't really matter that much, right? Like, if that player performs and does what I want him to do, hits the home run or scores the goal or whatever, I'm like, I guess I hear you that he's a bit of a jerk otherwise, but whatever. You know, it's like, well, that's, you know, ultimately, I need to be more concerned about that person's soul and what they're doing for eternity and whether or not my witness is being affected by cheering this guy on, I think, than whether or not my team wins. I see that applied in politics a lot these days, where it does seem like, you know, we just pick sides and it doesn't matter what our side does, that if our side does it, we're going to dismiss it. If the other side does it, we're not going. We're going to jump on it. All that to say, I recognize that on both sides of the political aisle, for example, we've got people in power who are doing bad things, right?
I mean, and just recently, Jimmy Moore pleaded guilty to filing a false campaign finance report, basically because they're trying to cover up almost a $90,000 payment to this person to drop out of the race for Congress.
These are two longstanding Democratic politicians, and one guy gave the other guy almost $100,000 to drop out of the race. And so he took it, and now he's facing bribery charges. Thankfully, they got caught, because I feel like this happens a lot.
But this isn't the only one. You know, someone and you as well were telling me about this huge break of money that was being pushed to the pharmaceutical companies. You have what's happening with Weinstein and how he's abusing these women that come to work for him. And it just makes me ask this question again. Where are your values? What is your belief system? But then after that, what sustains you through that? Because we're living in a time right now, and I was just telling you before the show, every single day I receive multiple advertisements for contraception. Every single day, men are bombarded with pornography. If I didn't have a strong faith, if I didn't have a strong sense of accountability, you know, there's a reason that a lot of people are not only going to confession monthly right now, people of good faith, but I try to go weekly if I can. And it's not because I'm some great person, but because I know I need that constant accountability before our Lord to grow and become greater in his presence, not of our own doing. And that's where you see how are people battling the desire for sexuality with no consequences, or for sex without looking at pornography, if they are not rooted somehow in good friendships, in our Lord, in the sacraments. I don't know how people can stand today.
Yeah, the accountability thing is big. And on one hand, obviously, we need a little bit more accountability, but I want to be careful here, because how this plays out is, so you see a politician who did something wrong. Well, I'm going to hold him accountable. I'm going to post something on Facebook. And well, okay. You know, yes, we need to keep all of these things in the light, like the pharmaceutical thing that just happened. An excellent example, the pharmaceutical companies have been paying off politicians, which we know, for right. years and years and years. And because of that, they get certain laws passed, and then they get basically the politicians trade places with the lobbyists, and the lobbyists become politicians, and the money keeps flowing, and the laws keep getting passed, and the truth gets squashed, and it's an ugly, ugly thing. Somehow we need to keep those people accountable. But even on a more personal basis, I think of a guy like Tim Murphy, the Republican from Pennsylvania, who recently had to resign. A big pro-life guy, frankly, you know, passing the right laws and this sort of thing, but also a guy who had an affair, got whoever it was, is the woman he was having an extramarital affair with, got her pregnant, and then encouraged her to have an abortion. Somebody needs to be in Mr. Murphy's life, right? Also keeping him accountable. And I just feel like sometimes with these, especially with these people in power, like Weinstein or Murphy or any of these guys, these people in power, there's so much money flowing around them and so much access that they can grant and all of these things and so much cheerleading that comes from different areas that it's very difficult for them to remain accountable. And so that's why, you know, was it the last show we talked a little bit about the Me Too campaign? That's why I like it. In general, I like that campaign because the more we can keep this out in the open, that this sexual abuse happens and we're not going to stand for it anymore, that sort of thing has to happen. But I would say even in our respective, you know, if you're a Democrat, you should be very upset about this bribery scandal. And if you're a Republican, you should be very upset about Mr. Lott trying to get an abortion for his mistress. All of us should be upset about both of those, I guess, is what I'm saying, and that we need to keep them all accountable and not just pick sides so often. And keep them so much money. Timmy, is there any way to keep money out of politics?
Oh, I thought you were going to say keep it in your pants.
Well, that would be good. Yes.
Oh, speaking of which.
Yeah, sorry.
Speaking of which, on a different kind of lighter note, but also interesting looking, you know, there's this piece that was put up on First Things, and it's the death of Eros, basically asking, is passionate love, have we lost it? Because Eros in and of itself is not bad if it's connected to, you know, Eros is passionate love, but connected to other forms of love like philia, friendship, or agape, sacrificial, selfless love are good. But it's looking at how, you know, people are actually there. Some stats are saying that people are, especially within marriages, having less sex than ever before. And they're pointing to the fact that, well, we just jump into bed with people before we even get to know them, which we talk a lot about here on the show.
Yeah.
And all these different elements, but how there are also other contributing factors, like we're all taking contraception and there's a decrease in libido as a result. There's an impact on, again, that sexual drive and all of this element of the body's in a state of pseudo-pregnancy. And we're ignoring the fact that our sexuality is something good but that's been so disrespected that we're removing it almost more and more so from the culture.
We've killed love and we've killed sex. This comes from an article by Mark Regnerus, who we talked to actually a few weeks ago. You can go to the podcast. Basically, we have made sex so cheap that we no longer do it anymore. Like, people are having less sex and they're having less marriage. They're basically in love less, properly understood.
Right.
So we've got less sex, less love, and less marriage. It's kind of this, you know what, you make anything really cheap? I think of, like, you want to have an event, if you're an event planner and you start to give away tickets, a lot of times that will actually decrease your audience because people don't see the value in it.
Well, I was just going to say it devalues something. When it's more accessible, it's less valuable. And that's what's excellent in this piece that is talked about, is how for women, there's this sense of, are you going to sacrifice for me? Are you going to have a job that can provide properly for us and our family? And that's when we can have that faithful fidelity, that commitment that we talked about, Princess Bride, at the beginning.
Right.
It makes a big impact of when we will then give our sexuality in a safe, loving, permanent, faithful context.
From the studios of Relevant Radio, this has been Trending with Dawn and Timory. Trending. To learn more about Dawn Johnson or Timory Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit DawnJohnsonMinistries.org or Timory.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.